You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. William Link, who passed away in December 2020, was a legendary writer and producer who, along with his partner Richard Levinson, who died in 1987, created the greatest television detective ever, Columbo. 10 years ago, William Link wrote a great collection of new Columbo stories, and on that occasion, I got to speak with him. So today, let's listen back to my 2010 interview with William Link.
It's a lovely little book for Columbo fans. Did these stories come to you recently, or are they untold tales of Columbo that were never realized as episodes?
No, they have nothing to do with any of the segments, and they're all brand new. Never published before except in this book.
The stories kind of break a little with the Columbo format. We don't always see the murder first and watch Columbo solve it.
Correct. Peter and I had discussed this, and also when Dick was with us, and we always said, Peter and us, we said, we should do, maybe change format a little bit and have an unknown murderer and make it a whodunit, because, as you know, what we had done on TV was you always see the murderer right at the top planning the murder and executing it, and then in comes Columbo. He has no cards in his hand. All the aces are held by the murderer. So, the whole fascination was, how is Columbo going to get the goods on the murderer, starting basically from scratch, with the murder itself?
It always seemed to me...
We never got around to doing that, probably because, and Peter agreed, the format that we were doing was so successful, why change it? Don't cure a hit, as we say in the business.
It always seemed to me like a little bit of a chess game, which is why I thought it was great when you did have him with Lawrence Harvey as the chess champion.
Yes. Yes.
There are many episodes of Columbo that are my favorites. I love A Stitch in Crime with Leonard Nimoy, and I love Etude in Black with John Cassavetes, which I think you wrote the story for.
Yes, and, the first one he did, a person you might have heard of, Steven Spielberg.
Right.
He directed Murder by the Book. That was our first on-the-air Columbo. He was a kid then. I still call him the kid to this day, even though, he's in his 60s and he's white-bearded.
Yeah.
But he did a brilliant job, and
that was with
21
Lee Grant.
Years old, he knew everything. Just incredible.
That was with Lee Grant, I recall.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what about you? What are your favorite Columbo episodes?
Pardon?
Which are your favorite Columbo episodes?
Mine was Any Old Port in a Storm.
Oh, yes, with Donald Pleasence.
Right. That was a very good one, and I remember it had a rather touching ending where he says to Columbo, I forget now, something Columbo said, that was never said to me before. And it was rather touching. I just don't remember exactly what it is. I haven't seen that episode in a while.
That's a great one. Well, how did you and your partner, Richard Levinson, meet?
We met the first day of junior high school. That was where two schools in suburban Philadelphia, a place called Elkins Park, where I grew up. Dick was, he came from West Oak Lane in Philadelphia. But two schools amalgamated, and I was told beforehand to look for a tall guy who did magic and wrote mysteries, and some of Dick's friends said he should look for a short guy who did magic and wrote mysteries. And we met at recess, and we were together for 43 years until Dick's untimely death. I could never get him off the cigarettes.
Oh,
and he knew it would kill him. But could I try to get him on cigars, what you don't inhale. Couldn't do it. He was hooked.
Well, when did you start collaborating professionally with him?
Pardon?
When did you begin your professional collaboration with him?
Well, we sold short stories when we were young. The first one we sold was to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, to Fred Danné, who was the editor for many years. And he was one half of the Ellery Queen partnership. And Dick and I loved the Ellery Queen novels when we were kids. And they published our first short story. Fred published it in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Whistling While You Work, about a mailman in Cooper, Colorado, a small town, fictional, of course, who kills his wife. But there was no Columbo in that story. We you know, created Columbo many years later.
Yes, of course, you had many other successes before Columbo, because you got into television in the 50s, correct?
We got into television our first... Well, we got out of the Army. We were drafted. And when we got out, we were riding by, you know... airmail then, while we were in the service, because we were not together in the service. Dick was mostly in the United States, and I was stationed in Germany. So we would collaborate by mail, airmail, as I said. And when we got out, we sold stories, and we had written two screenplays, scripts, that we sold to Canada, to General Motors. That was their big anthology show on Sunday nights up there. And we flew up to see the rehearsals and everything, and we were hooked. We loved early television. I had a television set, if you can believe it, in 1946.
Wow, was there
anything
on?
There were only three shows on a week. Uh-huh. You'd wait all week to see the shows, and the amazing thing is, the first anthology series, not anthology, but the first series on television was called Barney Blake Police Reporter, and it was a crime series. And that was the first mystery series ever on American television. And but when we got out of the Army, all the shows we wanted to write for, the anthology shows in New York City, Philco Playhouse, Kraft Theater, U.S. Steel Hour, they had all been mowed down by the guns of the Untouchables, a film show from Hollywood, and everything had gone east to Hollywood. That was the advent of the Private Eyes and the Westerns, everything on film. And the handwriting was on the wall, and Dick and I knew we had to come out to Los Angeles if we wanted to write for television. And that's what we did many, many years ago. We came out in 1959. I drove across the country with a friend, and it was my first time. And Dick flew out, and then we got together out here, and the rest is history.
We're chatting with William Link, the creator of Columbo. Tell me about your collaboration with Richard Levinson. How did you collaborate exactly? What was it like?
For 43 years, it was Dick, a typewriter back then, and I would pace. We wrote every single line together. We had plotted the whole thing out. You know, the key time is when you structure, you know, a story. That's when you get it all together, first act, second act, third act. And then the writing is just something we did by rote. And eventually, right before Dick died, the computer came in, but Dick would never, I knew then he would never use a computer, because he had to literally hammer the keys as we wrote. He wanted that give on the keys. We both had the same typewriters, a Swiss typewriter back then. And I knew he wouldn't go to a computer because, you know, on a computer, Gary, you don't hammer the keys. You know, it's a soft touch, really.
Yeah.
So I know he would never switch over, but then unfortunately he passed away.
Well,
so
yes.
I continued, and that was tough because I didn't know whether I could write alone. And so I sat down and wrote an original screenplay, and I sold it to Universal for $500,000, and I figured I can write without Dick. We were very lucky in that we were both strong in the various elements, creating characters, construction, atmospherics, all those elements. And we were, that's what saved me, because I could do all those just like I did when I worked with Dick.
Well, you know, there was a Columbo episode, I'm sure you know, where I believe it was Jack Cassidy played a mystery writer, and he had a partner, and it was his partner who had done all the work.
Yes.
And I was wondering, was that based on YouTube?
Well, that was the one that Spielberg directed.
Uh-huh.
And the big joke at Universal Studios then, where Dick and I were under a long-term contract, was who killed who? Did Link kill Levinson, or did Levinson kill Link? That joke went around the studio.
Well, before Columbo, you had major success with Mannix. Was that your...
Yeah, that was our first big hit. We were very young then.
That was at CBS, I believe.
Yeah, we did the pilot, and then we left the show. We had other fish to fry. Usually Dick and I didn't want to hang around after we wrote the pilot. We became consultants on several of the shows. That meant, you know, we read scripts, made comments, notes, and sometimes worked with writers, but that was fairly infrequent.
But with Columbo, you were the producer of the show.
Yes. We produced the show for the first season. Then after that, we staffed it with other very good producers, Stephen Bochco, and some others I just don't remember now. It was a long time ago. But we always, on Columbo, because we really loved you know, that series, especially with Falk, and we always gave notes. After every episode or before, we always had lunch at the commissary with Peter Falk and discussed it and gave him notes. And that was our real baby of everything that we had created. And Dick, before he died, said, "You will not say on my tombstone any of the series. It will say co-created Columbo." And in a way, he was right, except he doesn't have a tombstone. He's in a receptacle with his ashes. And I've seen that, and it doesn't say on it, you know, co-created Columbo. But he was wrong in that sense. You know, Columbo was our baby from the beginning.
Now,
and I can't believe how successful it still is now. I mean, as we speak, it's touring Great Britain before it comes into the West End and doing extremely well. And the Japanese were over here 2 years ago interviewing me or filming me for an hour and a half in the interview, because the Japanese are still obsessed with Columbo. They just can't let go of it.
Well, because it's great, I think.
Go ahead.
I think it's because it's so great.
Yeah, that might be it. You know, I don't know. It's people love that series. I mean, when the cops were over here today, they saw a poster we had for the book, and they said, "Columbo, what's that?" And I told them that I co-created it, and they were so... They were overwhelmed by that. And they said, "Well, how do we get the books?" And I said, "Go to your nearest bookstore, go on Amazon now, and you can get the Columbo collection. If you really like the series, I guarantee you'll like the stories."
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're listening back this week to my interview with the late William Link, who passed away in 2020, and who, along with his partner, the late Richard Levinson, created Columbo. Peter Falk is Columbo for all of us, but he was not your first choice for Columbo, is that right?
No. Columbo was first a stage play, or before that, there was a writer's strike, and Dick at the 1960, and Dick and I had always said, if a if it wasn't for that strike, we probably would have never created the COP. What happened was we went back to New York, which was our favorite city. We never liked L.A. that much, and I still don't to this day. It's okay. And it's incredibly deteriorated, the city, since when we came out here in 1959. And what was I saying?
You were telling us about how you created Colombo.
Yeah. So during the strike, we sat down, clever people that we were. We knew the Writers Guild contract in the fine print. You couldn't write for film television, but you could write for live television. And we saw that summer, we'd gone back east, we were bachelors then, we rented a huge apartment at 72nd and Broadway that was owned by a director named Stuart Rosenberg, a very fine director. He did a lot of very good feature films, including Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman. And we rented his apartment during the strike because we figured it would be a long strike, and it was 5.5 months. But we enjoyed ourselves in New York. But that's when we sat down and we wrote a live show script called Enough Rope. If you give a murderer enough rope, he'll hang himself. You know, that was the old maxim way back then. And so we wrote that script, and our agent said, this will never sell. We sent it out, and it was bought. And then when the strike was over, we came back out to Los Angeles, which was then, you know, going to be our home, it looked like, unfortunately. And I've been here now, you know, over half a century. And that began, we realized that the stage play before that was a hit. It was produced by a man named Paul Gregory, who back then was a big-time Broadway producer. And we had a dynamite cast. We adapted it for the stage. We had Thomas Mitchell playing Columbo, you know, the great character actor. You know, he was the drunken doctor and stagecoach. He played many cops. He was the father in Gone with the Wind. Wonderful actor. Irish-American actor. And that really was the beginning, because the play, Prescription Murder, played all over the United States and Canada, and it was very successful. And then we sold that play to Universal a couple years after, and that was the true beginning, because then, you know, we sat in our bungalow at Universal and we said, you know, who's going to play? Thomas Mitchell died during our run in Philadelphia and into the hospital. He had colon cancer. And unfortunately, he passed on. And Dick and I said, well, we can't get Thomas Mitchell. You know, who are we going to cast? And Peter Falk, we had known in New York. We used to have lunch with him. He was just starting out acting. Did some things on Broadway. And we had the same agent at William Morris, the agency we were with in those days, after we got out of the Army. And in Hollywood now, we got a phone call where we were trying to say, who are we going to get to play Columbo now? Peter called out of the blue, and he said, I got this script, Prescription Murder, and I'll kill to play that cop. And he said, you know, he would be perfect. We didn't even audition him. He had the role right there.
Well, he's quite a bit younger than Thomas Mitchell.
Yeah. Columbo started out young. And, you know, the stage play is still being done, as I mentioned before, all over the place.
Yeah.
Europe, the French are obsessed with Columbo.
Well, who plays Columbo in the stage version now?
A gentleman who was in Star Trek. The series here.
Oh.
His name, I think his last name is Benedict or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he got great reviews in this tour. I mean, they really like him. But through the years, I mean, many, many actors have played Columbo on the stage.
Really?
Yeah. I have the royalties to prove it. So, It's been amazing. Of all, you know, the 16 series we had on the air, which is still probably some kind of record that we had created, Columbus still shines as the most popular, even more popular than Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah, now Murder, She Wrote had quite a long run also.
Which one?
Murder, She Wrote had quite a long run also.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And were you producers of Murder, She Wrote also, or did you leave the show?
We started out again the first year. We created that with a man named Peter Fisher. And we were the ones who cast Angela Lansbury. At that time, very, very few people in America outside of New Yorkers really knew who she was. She'd been in some feature pictures. The one she did with Frank Sinatra, she was the murdering mother.
The Manchurian Candidate.
But she was basically a Broadway actress.
Mm-hmm.
So what was good there is when we cast her, America really discovered her. You know, she was like their discovery, which added a lot to the popularity of that show. Besides her being... you know, a wonderful actress, and she's still with us. She lives back in New York now.
Right.
And she was wonderful to deal with. She's just a terrific human being, Angela.
Well, I want to ask you also about some of those great TV movies that you wrote back in
Yes, we love those. Those were our favorite things, really.
Which ones were your favorites?
We love That Certain Summer, which was the first play about homosexuality.
Hal Holbrook was the star.
Yes, Hal Holbrook and Marty Sheen. And then we put Sheen, we loved his performance, and we put him in Execution of Private Slovak. And we made a television star out of Marty. I'm very proud of that. He's a, well, he's an activist, and he's been arrested, I think, a couple times. Wonderful actor and a terrific person. And Hal is still with us, and the same thing with him.
That was a very controversial film, That Certain Summer.
Yes. The night it was on, ABC affiliates got threats, bomb threats, against their stations. That's how controversial it was. We also did another picture like called The Gun, which was The Travels of an American Handgun. We took incredible flack from the National Rifle Association. They damned us in their publication. They said we made a hero of an Army deserter, Private Slovak, that put up two perverts in That Certain Summer. It was just very ugly. And they had a writing campaign against ABC, the network. They had thousands of people to write in, and ABC was intimidated. They were licensed to show That Certain Summer twice, once in prime time and then again that summer, and they never showed it again that summer. They were so intimidated.
I don't think it's ever been shown again, has it?
Not to my knowledge. The sad thing, Gary, is that a lot of those movies of the week, Universal is not keeping the negatives in proper shape because there's no venue. I don't know where you are, but there's no movies of the week. I mean, Dick and I, we think, you know, we made some fine ones, but there were plenty of other quality producers who made equally fine movies of the week.
Well, that was that era in the 1970s. It was a high point for that. There were quite a few good ones, including the two that you mentioned, and there was also, I remember, the Glass House.
Excellent. There was the Radon and Tebby.
Uh-huh. A War of Children was another good one.
Yeah, I mean, many of those pictures.
Of course, Brian's Song is another one that comes to
mind.
Yeah,
Brian's Song was beautiful.
Yeah.
I saw that, actually. They brought that back, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And I cried again at the end.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And it takes a lot to make me cry, let me tell you. That was excellent. That was written by a very fine writer named Tracy Keenan Wynn, who's been out of the business a long time, like I have.
Yeah. Wait, so, but you're not completely retired because you're writing Columbo stories.
Oh, yeah. And all my short stories, I write the non-Columbo short stories that are published all the time. In fact, in the recent issue of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. That was sort of Dixon, our home through the years. And I like to write short stories more than Dick did. And we didn't write them for a long while. We were, you know, working very hard, you know, doing our television things. But that was sort of home base for us. And the current issue of Ellery Queen has a story of mine, non-Columbo.
Do you feel this new book, The Columbo Collection, is the first in a series? You're going to write some more Columbos for us?
Oh, yes. Well, what the publisher doesn't know, what I'm telling you, and I'll probably get back to him, is if this collection, Gary, does well, and it seems to be doing quite well, I wrote 27 Columbo short stories.
Oh, goody.
My goal is to write 50. In fact, today when I was in the waiting for the doctor, when we were away, when our house was being burglarized, it turns out, I plotted a whole new Columbo short story, including the big clue at the end. And so, no, I'm going to continue to write Columbos.
And
you can count on that.
And are you ever tempted, just because you know you could do it, are you ever tempted to commit murder, Mr. Link?
No. As I said before, I don't own a weapon. I'm scared of guns. And I never hated anybody enough. I'm just not a hate person.
Do you think you can get away with
no
it,
there's no chance of that. I only do it on paper. I committed plenty of murders on paper. But that's it for me.
Well, I want to remind everybody that the book is called The Columbo Collection.
Yes.
And the author is William Link, creator of Columbo, along with his partner, the late Richard Levinson. William Link, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure, Gary. I hope your listeners will go out, then get it on Amazon. It should be in all the bookstores later this month.
William Link, the creator of Columbo, who passed away in December of 2020. Terry Kirkman was a founding member of the band The Association, and a few years ago, he discussed his career with me. Today, we take another listen to that interview. Here is Terry Kirkman. The Association, they were a great group in the 60s. They had a unique sound with wonderful harmonies. What was their origin story?
We formed at Los Angeles. We were originally in a folk group that was the house band at the Troubadour, still a major club in the United States and arguably one of the top two or three most powerful clubs, showcase places in the country, if not the world then. And just by fluke, we ended up being the house band, a group of guys, all guys, and we were called the Men, and we were the first group in the United States working act to be called folk rock.
Before the Birds, you say?
The Birds were actually, when they were the Beefeaters,
yep.
They were rehearsing in the front room of the Troubadour, and we were rehearsing in the big room.
Oh.
And we were the first people in print,
to
whatever kind of claim that is.
No, that's a major claim, isn't it?
To be called folk rock.
Did you get along well with Doug Weston, the owner of the Troubadour?
Nobody did.
So how did the Men become the Association?
The Men was too big to sustain itself. It was originally a 13-person act, and then it was an 11. And if you're only making a few hundred dollars a week, then you can't pull it off. Even though we had a folk house, a really nice house that we all lived in, or most of the guys lived in, like that. You couldn't do it. And so we, six of us, walked out of the room one day and kind of split the Men down the middle without any animosity, just, I think we're done here. And within a couple of hours, we had named ourselves the Association, more as a kind of a joke than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
I love that album cover of all the Association album covers. I like the one where it's like Stonehenge that says the Association. Were you with the band when they did that one?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a great cover. I remember at least the Association records that I had were on Warner Brothers, but you were originally on a different label.
We were on a label called Valiant that was actually formed around us and two other acts. Shelby Flint, who is a wonderful female singer, who has been one of the highest paid studio singers in Los Angeles for all these decades. And I don't remember who the third act was.
Well, how did Valiant Records come to be in your life? How did that happen?
They auditioned for acts, and I just like with the men, I was almost through the association. We had a fan club of 20,000 people, and we couldn't get a record deal because nobody could identify the genre of our music, which is really hard to get your head around right now. It was one thing if you were playing straight-ahead folk rock, but Along Comes Mary and Cherish and some of the other songs we were doing on our first album defined categorization as far as the record world was concerned. And if a marketing people can't sell it, if they don't have an outlet for it, they're not going to buy it. So while we had that 20,000 people as a fan club and could guarantee at least 20,000 records, nobody would touch us because there wasn't a radio format set up to play that music yet.
But nevertheless, Valiant signed you, and did you have a hit record right away or not?
We got some noise with our first thing, and which was One Too Many Mornings, the Bob Dylan song.
Bob Dylan song,
And then we released Along Comes Mary.
Oh, and were you writing songs then?
Yes.
And so I remember seeing you guys on the Smothers Brothers show.
We were quite close with the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah?
Yeah. Sherry Smothers, their sister, lived in the big folk house with all the rest of us. And we were all a part of the same folk club circuit. And the Smothers Brothers were a folk act.
They weren't
a television act. They were a folk act that played the Ice House and the Troubadour and all the rest of the Purple Onion.
We're chatting with Terry Kirkman, and he was one of the founding members of the association. So was that one of your first big television appearances on the Smothers Brothers, or had you guys been on a lot before that?
You know, in writing an article today for HuffPost, I was researching my own group.
Yeah.
And I ran across a blurb that said that we were on every major television show. Smothers Brothers would have been way down the line in terms of our performances. We were the first self-contained rock group ever on the Andy Williams Show, which was the biggest show in the country at the time. I think we were the first self-contained rock group on the Mike Douglas Show.
Oh, yeah, that's one of our favorites.
We're the Red Skelton Show, the Steve Allen Show, all sorts of specials. There's about 40 or 50 major television shows, two Sullivan shows.
Were you surprised when this all happened to you?
Everybody is.
No one is prepared for that.
When it starts to happen at that rate, it's both a blessing and a curse.
What were some of the curse aspects of it?
You're not prepared to handle it. Effects that it has on you psychologically in terms of, do I deserve this? Don't I deserve it? Do I want this much attention? Why can't I be alone? What am I doing on the road 250 days a year? What happened to my private life? Too much too fast, you know.
Yeah.
It messes as many people up as it does help them.
A few months ago, we had an author on the show. His name is Kent Hartman, and he wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew. It was all about the studio musicians who played on dozens of 60s hits. And his book says that the association didn't play the instruments on their records. Is that true or false?
True.
And how did you guys feel about that? Was that okay?
No, it was. In our first album, we had studio musicians and ourselves. Our second album, we played a lot of our own instruments. And once we got into the Warner Brothers thing, Warner's wanted our albums done like clockwork. So the plane that we did with Valiant was more on our own terms. And it's hard to remember that our first album was done on 2 4-track machines.
Hmm.
Okay. So whatever overdubbing or anything that was even remotely resemble an effect or multiple tracking was a very, very painstaking business of transferring one machine to another, back to the other, trying to get the levels right so they would master well. And the, you know, it was, honest to God, rocket science. Then when we got into the, when Jerry Ester got fired by Warner Brothers as our third album, and Bones Howe was hired because he'd done the Mamas and the Papas.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually the engineer, he wasn't the producer.
Mm.
Warner Brothers started having a lot of mandates, and so we were doing complete albums, and I mean complete. Entering it, just sitting down to do the song selection, and then think about arranging them and how the whole album would sound, to the very, very end, all in 40 days.
Wow.
And that's 12 songs. And groups now routinely take several months to a year or 2 or 3 years to do an album.
Well, even your contemporaries, like, say, the Beatles, took 6 months to make Sgt. Pepper.
Yes.
But, yeah, now, of course, they
take... No, the Eagles routinely began to take a year to do an album. Stevie Wonder would take a year. The Doors would take a few months. Brian Wilson spent 6 months working on Good Vibrations.
Just one song. Yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
Well, so did you stand by as a group your records, or did you feel that the records were not you?
Both.
You recently wrote in the Huffington Post about Cherish, and I sort of think of Cherish as a slow song, but you said it was too fast.
It was certainly faster than I heard it in my head when I wrote it.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't a particularly danceable tune.
No.
Which saddened me. And lots of our tunes did not come out that were intended to be more danceable weren't. I think when you have a democratic group and you have that kind of swept away scheduling hassle, when your life becomes so dense and so filled with being on the road, if you're on the road over 200 days a year, and you're trying to be creative, and that's 200 back-to-back-to-back-to-back days. That's no sit-down. Very, very rarely more than 3 or 4 days of sit-down, you know, like being in a town where you're not hopping on a plane or getting on a bus or driving off someplace. You know, we were carbon. By the time I left the group, I was so burnt out, and not from drugs and booze. I was just done.
Just from the grind of performing.
The grinding, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Almost nobody's marriage survived.
Really?
And
actually, one of the members of the group did not survive, your bass player.
Brian Cole died in August 3rd, August 4th. 40 years ago.
72. And then you left the group shortly thereafter. Was there a connection?
I left a year and a half after that.
Mm-hmm.
The last album he performed on was the last album I recorded with the Associates. I was done. I also wanted to leave the group to do anti-war work, civil rights work that I thought was actually more important than getting up and
making a pop record.
Yeah, making a pop record or wiggling my butt on stage to to date night crowds.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're listening back to a conversation I recorded a few years ago with Terry Kirkman, founding member of the band The Association. And I asked Terry Kirkman to tell us about the Monterey Pop Festival, for which The Association were the opening act.
We were. It was sort of like being cannon fodder for the for the Viet Cong. We were sort of the sound check, lighting check. That's a really frustrating topic for me. It always has been. We had just finished an album. Had we had the album material in our repertoire just 4 weeks later, had we played that just 4 weeks later, I think our experience would have been totally different. We would have performed Requiem for the Masses, and there was no song like that that had ever been done by a pop group.
Yeah.
The United States government stomped all over it when it was the B-side to Never My Love. Major markets flipped it over. Requiem for the Masses is an anti-war song.
Right. And a great one.
You know, and our opening thing, and two of us begged the group not to do it. We had a little piece of shtick that we would do in date night crowds that was called the Association Machine. It was just totally wrong for the Monterey Pop Festival. But we sang well, we performed well, and kind of got cut out of the mix. But a lot of people, Otis Redding, or Nero, lots of people walked away from that festival really unhappy about what had been represented up front and what they got in return, you know. But the public sees it only in iconic context. I had friends who lost tens of thousands of dollars at the Woodstock thing.
Really?
It was a mess. People who, you know, were asked to come up and provide food, you know, like $60,000 worth of hamburger and hot dog, and the trucks were ripped open. And
people just stole it.
People were eating raw meat.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Hey, you don't see that in the movie or whatever.
No. And all that money that was supposed to be given to legalize marijuana out of the Monterey Pop Festival, I don't think more than a few bucks ever made it to that.
We're talking with Terry Kirkman, and he was one of the founding members of the Association, and for the last 22 years you've been an addictions counselor, and you kind of work with a lot of people who were in show business?
Yes. I my last big job was clinical director of the Musicians Assistance Program, MAP, which has now, with the death of the founder of MAP, was absorbed into the Grammy Foundation's Music Cares program. And what we did at MAP, we were completely autonomous. There was about five of us doing this huge amount of work, and our budget was $2 million a year, and we gave 70% of it away to uninsured rank-and-file musicians, all professional people, or anybody in the music business who was having substance abuse problems.
Terry Kirkman, founding member of the band The Association. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.